All right, we're continuing our study with chapter 15 of Joshua. In the latter part of Joshua, we're going to move fast. The next chapters have to do with the various allotments for the tribes. There are a few significant things there. One is that all those historical places were important to the children of Israel because no matter what tribe you were a part of, this is how you ended up where you ended up. So it would be like studying American history and learning about all the various places that were settled in California. Other people may not be interested in the varying names, but we are. So the same thing happens here. Judah is very important. The children of Israel entered in the center of, they cut right through the middle of Cana. And the tribe of Judah is very strong. It was successful in the south. But in the north, things did not go as well. And we see that reflected in history later on, because while neither Judah nor Israel, when there was the divided kingdom, did remarkably well, there was no good king in Israel after Solomon. So chapter 15 is the allotment for Judah, and you can see that that's quite lengthy there. Chapter 16 is the allotment for Ephraim and Manasseh, and these are the tribes of Joseph. The two sons of Joseph are given, each given an inheritance, and Levi doesn't have one, and they were the second most powerful. So oftentimes, the northern kingdom later on is known as Ephraim in Israel, but Ephraim. Manasseh is less well known. Ephraim kind of takes over. Chapter 17 continues the allotment for the tribe of Manasseh. We'll keep on going there until we get to verse 12 of chapter 17. Let's look there. And this is kind of what happens now, and it is the reason why, is it the reason why? So the reason is because of unbelief, but what happened here resulted in all the rest of Israel's history. So, yet the Manassites were not able to occupy these towns that were named. And among them were Beit Shan, if you're looking at 11, Beit Shan and Megiddo. Beit Shan is where the Esdraelon and Jezreel valleys come together. It was a critical point. Saul and his sons were killed, they didn't. And Megiddo is a major fortress. Hebrew word for mountain is Har. Har Megiddo, Armageddon. That's where the word Armageddon comes from, because great battles were fought there. So these were important places, but the Manassites were not able to occupy these towns. Now, why is that ridiculous?
God commanded them to do it,
and God was with them. So they copped out some way. They decided, they look pretty strong. We need to get a crop in. We can't do all this fighting. Who knows what.
There's a question I have. When they took Jericho, went out against Ai, all the people of or fighting men of Israel were there. Now it turns the other way. It says, well, this is your territory. You take it.
But that's what they did. That was the strategy. They went straight into the center of Canaan, and then they said to the tribe of Judah, we've broken the back of the resistance. You go south, Will and the others, whatever they were, should go north. Yeah. It wasn't dependent on the number of soldiers. They should have realized that they could take it. They only took a few up to Ai, and it wasn't that they took too few, it's that they didn't listen to the Lord. That was what the problem was.
But who was Caleb of the tribe of Judah?
Blank.
I don't remember.
No. Yeah, it's the brother of Judah captured it. He was a Jew.
And Caleb is coming up. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Oh, he asked to take Hebron.
Yeah.
Yeah, later.
So it would seem.
It would seem he was of Judah, but
yeah.
I
don't know. In the 12, you look in the 12 spies, but if the tribes are.
But Joshua was of Ephraim.
Yeah.
But even Judah didn't take all the cities.
No, but they did much better.
Yeah.
And the degree to which they succeeded tells the story after that, doesn't it? You know. So let's keep on going. We'll see some of this. 13. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. And that's what they were supposed to do. When we get to Judges, we'll talk about that. Now they're conquering the land. The story of the book of Judges is the story of what happened after in the next generation that did not know the Lord and remember the things that He did. And we'll talk about why God was so insistent on them driving the Canaanites out or killing them.
Joshua said, "For me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And they didn't do that. Now, how can we compare it? How does that? We see the church fall, you know, in our country falling today. How can we?
Or what lesson do we learn?
To put the two together.
Well, the lesson is that you have to do what the Lord wants you to do. No excuses. If you don't do what the Lord wants you to do, you're going to pay the price. And that's exactly what happened. But again, when we get to Judges, we'll be able to put this in a bigger perspective. So now we're conquering the land. And the writer of Joshua, the chronicler, is telling us that they did not follow God's command. So verse 14. The people of Joseph said to Joshua, the people of Joseph are Ephraim and Manasseh, "Why have you given us only one allotment and one portion for an inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly." "If you are so numerous," Joshua answered, "and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest, into the mountains, and clear land for yourselves there in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaites." The people of Joseph replied, "The hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the plain have iron chariots." both those in Bashan and its settlements and those in the valley of Jezreel. So you have these beautiful valleys, and they're saying, well, yeah, we can cut down the trees and grow a little land up in the hills, but they're too tough for us. Israel never changes. And so people today have all kinds of excuses for why they can't do what the Lord is asking them to do. You know, so we got iron chariots today too. But Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, "You are numerous and very powerful. You will have not only one allotment, but the forested hill country as well. Clear it, and its farthest limits will be yours. Though the Canaanites have iron chariots, and though they are strong, you can drive them out. And you can hold the heights and attack the ones in the plain." Basically, that's what he's saying. Okay, let's keep on going in the first part of chapter 18. The whole assembly of the Israelites gathered at Shiloh, and set up the tent of meeting there. So the tent of meeting has been in different places, and now it gets set up in Shiloh, the tabernacle. The country was brought under their control, but there were still seven Israelite tribes who had not yet received their inheritance. So Joshua said to the Israelites, "How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? Appoint 3 men from each tribe. I will send them out to make a survey of the land and to write a description of it according to the inheritance of each." So they can't get to it. They're worried about the Canaanites who are in the land and so forth. So let's go out and we'll put down a written description of each tribe's inheritance. And when they're done doing that and have written it all down, then they will return to me. You are to divide the land into 7 parts for the tribes that don't have their inheritance yet. Judah is to remain in its territory on the south, and the house of Joseph in its territory on the north. So these are kind of the anchor stores, if you will, in the mall. After you have written the descriptions, after you have written descriptions of the 7 parts of the land, bring them here to me. Now, one of the problems may be that they couldn't agree. So Joshua is just settling the argument. Now, we're going to get a written description, and I'm going to allot this land to you. So bring them here to me, and I will cast lots for you in the presence of the Lord our God at Shiloh. The Levites, however, do not get a portion among you, because the priestly service of the Lord is their inheritance. And Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have already received their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan. So half of the tribe of Manasseh, or the tribe of Manasseh, is split on either side of the Jordan. Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to them. That was the decision. As the men started on their way to map out the land, Joshua instructed them, "Go and make a survey of the land and write a description of it, then return to me." Sounds like surveying the Northwest Territories, if you remember your American history, and all those states, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, the Northwest Territories were all divided up. So the men left and went through the land. They wrote its description on a scroll town by town in 7 parts and returned to Joshua in the camp at Shiloh. Joshua then cast lots for them in Shiloh in the presence of the Lord. And there he distributed the land to the Israelites according to their tribal divisions, just as it was planned. So then Benjamin, which is down on the south side with Judah, is given their allotment. Simeon is in chapter 19. Zebulun, Issachar, and Asher, and Dan continue in 19. The tribe of Dan, look at verse 47 of chapter 19. But the Danites had difficulty taking possession of their territory, so they went up and attacked Leshem, took it, put it to the sword, and occupied it. So they finally did what they needed to do. They settled in Leshem and named it Dan after their forefather. These towns and their villages were the inheritance of the tribe of Dan, clan by clan, that they were listed before. Special allotment for Joshua. When they had finished dividing the land into its allotted portions, the Israelites gave Joshua, son of Nun, an inheritance among them, as the Lord had commanded. They gave him the town he asked for, Timnath-Serah, sometimes known as Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim. Now, you know, when you said before that he was a member of the tribe of Ephraim, I'm not certain of that.
You
looked it up. Okay, all right. So it was natural then to give him that town in the inheritance of Ephraim. I was afraid that might not be true. I just didn't remember. And he built up the town and settled there. Remember, towns, this is like you have a walled city and you control a certain area. So the town doesn't just mean the town. It means that area that's controlled by that town. These are the territories that Eleazar the priest, Joshua son of Nun, and the heads of the tribal clans of Israel assigned by lot at Shiloh in the presence of the Lord at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And so they finished dividing the land. Now, if you remember from the Torah, the Pentateuch, Moses, the Lord told Moses to set up these cities of refuge. Yeah.
Well, there's one other I think that's worth mentioning, and that is Dan.
Mm-hmm.
They were up next to the Philistines, and they never really occupied the area, and they finally just all pulled up stakes and went up to the north.
North.
And decided it wasn't worth it.
Right, it was too difficult.
Too difficult to fight against the Philistines, so they left.
And that's reflected in verse 47. But the Danites had difficulty taking possession of their territory, so they went up and attacked Leshem, because it was easier.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. All right, you're right. Then the Lord said to Joshua, tell the Israelites, chapter 20, to designate the cities of refuge as I instructed you through Moses, so that anyone who kills a person accidentally and unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. When he, see, there was no police force, there's no one, so someone in the family is going to be the avenger of blood. When he flees to one of these cities, he is to stand in the entrance of the city gate and state his case before the elders of that city. Then they are to admit him into their city and give him a place to live with them. If the avenger of blood pursues him, they must not surrender the one accused because he killed his neighbor unintentionally and without malice aforethought. He is to stay in that city until he has stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who is serving at that time. So even no one can do any quickie deal because you have to wait until the high priest dies. Now, it's possible that maybe the high priest dies right then. But that's a slowing down of the process. Then he may go back to his own home in the town from which he fled. So they set apart Kedesh in Galilee in the hill country of Naphtali, Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that, and that's Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. On the east side of the Jordan of Jericho, they designated Bezer in the desert on the plateau in the tribe of Reuben, Ramoth in Gilead in the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan in the tribe of Manasseh. See, those areas, Transjordan or on the east side of the Jordan, were very much larger in area because they weren't agricultural lands. They were pasture lands, and that's what Gad those tribes wanted. They wanted to stay there. Gad and Manasseh, the half-tribe of Manasseh. Boy, tickle. Mm. All right. Chapter 21 describes the towns that were to be allotted to the Levites, and they were spread throughout the country. And that was important for the children of Israel because the Levites were part of the spiritual life of the children of Israel. So, take a look at verse 43 of chapter 21. So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their forefathers, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to his forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one of them was fulfilled. But the children of Israel were not faithful. God was. All right, now as we get toward the end of Joshua, we see the whole process of conquering the land coming to its conclusion. Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have done all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and you have obeyed me in everything I commanded. for a long time now, to this very day, you have not deserted your brothers, but have carried out the mission the Lord your God gave you. Now that the Lord your God has given your brothers rest as he promised, return to your homes in the land that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. But be very careful to keep the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to obey his commands, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul. So he's repeating the promises and commands that Moses had given to them previously. Serve the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul. Then Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their homes. To the half-tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given land in Bashan, and to the other half of the tribe, Joshua gave land on the west side of the Jordan with their brothers. When Joshua sent them home, he blessed them, saying, "Return to your homes with your great wealth, with large herds of livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and a great quantity of clothing, and divide with your brothers the plunder from your enemies." So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh left the Israelites at Shiloh in Canaan to return to Gilead, their own land, which they had acquired in accordance with the command of the Lord through Moses. When they came to Geliloth, near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Geliloth, near the Jordan on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. So the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. With him they sent 10 of the chief men, one for each of the tribes of Israel, each the head of a family division among the Israelite clans. When they went to Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, "The whole assembly of the Lord says, 'How could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now? Was not the sin of Peor enough for us?'" Sin of idolatry then. "Up to this very day, we have not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell on the community of the Lord. And are you now turning away from the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. If the land you possess is defiled, come over to the Lord's land, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and share the land with us." So, you know, it's the Lord's tabernacle that keeps the land from being defiled. "But do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of the Lord our God. When Achan, son of Zerah, acted unfaithfully regarding the devoted things," the things that were to be destroyed in Jericho, "did not wrath come upon the whole community of Israel? He was not the only one who died for his sin." Then Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, "The Mighty One, God the Lord, the Mighty One, God the Lord, he knows. And let Israel know. If this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account." So we've set up this altar, but it is not going to be the place where we're going to bring our offerings. That will always be the tabernacle of the Lord. "No, we did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, 'What do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord, so your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord.'" So they're both worried. They're worried about division and the breaking of fellowship. The tribes on the west side think that perhaps they're setting up an opposition altar. And they say, no, they're not. We're afraid that when we take off and go, you're going to say, well, let those Gadites and Reubenites do their own thing. They're their own people. Yes.
What was the sin of Peor?
I've forgotten.
Worshipping Baal.
Yeah.
I think.
But I can't remember it.
Have you got a note? 17. When some of the Israelites became involved in the Moabite worship of Baal.
Oh yes. Okay. Just need a reminder. Remember when they were coming on their way up at the end of the 40 years, the Moabites tempted them and they fell for it. And they worshiped Baal, which was going to be their problem. I couldn't remember. All right. Okay, verse 26. That because your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. In other words, division would come. That is why we said, let us get ready and build an altar, but not for burnt offerings or sacrifices. On the contrary, it is to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow that we will worship the Lord at his sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and fellowship offerings. Because where did they build this altar? That is a monument.
On the border between
Where it was is important. It was on the west side. They didn't build it on their side of the Jordan. They built it on the west side of the Jordan. So then in the future, latter part of what, verse 27? Then in the future, your descendants will not be able to say to ours, you have no share in the Lord. Look, that's our altar right there on your side. That's what they're saying. That will always be a connection between us. And we said, if they ever say this to us or to our descendants, we will answer, look at the replica of the Lord's altar, which our fathers built, not for burnt offerings and sacrifices, but as a witness between us and you. Far be it from us to rebel against the Lord and turn away from him today by building an altar for burnt offerings, grain offerings, and sacrifices other than the altar of the Lord our God that stands before his tabernacle. When Phinehas the priest and the leaders of the community, the heads of the clans of the Israelites, heard what Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh had to say, they were pleased. So it's hard to say exactly why this division grew so fast. I mean, after all, Gad and Reuben and Manasseh had fought, and everyone acknowledged that they had done their wrong, and it was time to go home. But maybe there was, you know, some sort of undercurrents going on, or who knows what. I mean, the people who read this first would have understood it. But it settled it, didn't it? The Transjordan Transjordan on the other side of the Jordan, those tribes made clear that they would be faithful to the Lord. And Phinehas, son of Eleazar, verse 31, the priest said to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, today we know that the Lord is with us because you have not acted unfaithfully toward the Lord in this matter. Now you have rescued the Israelites from the Lord's hand. So we were worried that judgment would come upon the whole nation because there was some idolatry going on, but you've made clear that that's not the case. Then Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, and the leaders returned to Canaan from their meeting with the Reubenites and Gadites in Gilead and reported to the Israelites. They were glad to hear the report and praised God, and they talked no more about going to war against them to devastate the country where the Reubenites and the Gadites lived. And the Reubenites and the Gadites gave the altar this name, a witness between us that the Lord is God. So clearly, the Lord found pleasure in this. There's in a subject as important as idolatry,
the Holy Spirit would not have allowed the writer to not make clear. And so I think we can be very clear that this was all done in with the proper motivation.
Where's the tabernacle?
Shiloh, right now. After a long time had passed, and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them, Joshua, by then old and well advanced in years, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and said to them, I am old and well advanced in years. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you. Remember how I have allotted as an inheritance for your tribes all the land of the nations that remain, the nations I conquered between the Jordan and the great sea in the west. The Lord your God himself will drive them out of your way. He will push them out before you, and you will take possession of their land as the Lord your God promised you. So another thing that's clear is this was a process. You know, in other words, the Lord has given them success, but there's still lots to be done. Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. Once again, the word of God is held up, and no variation from the word of God is to be allowed or will be brooked. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you are to hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs a thousand because the Lord your God fights for you, just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves, does that sound right? Ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. And that is exactly what happened. Now I am about to go all the way of all the earth. You know with all your heart and soul that not one of all the good promises the Lord your God gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled, not one has failed. But just as every good promise of the Lord your God has come true, so the Lord will bring on you all the evil he has threatened, until he has destroyed you from this good land he has given you. And this is God's promise as well. If you violate the covenant of the Lord your God which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you, and you will quickly perish from the good land he has given you. Then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. He summoned the elders, leaders, judges, and officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said to all the people, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago, your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the river and led him throughout Canaan and gave him many descendants." So this is the portion of the scripture that makes clear that Terah's problem and Nahor, Abraham's brother, was that they worshipped the Lord, but they worshipped other gods as well. And so God calls Abraham out, completely out, of the Tigris-Euphrates, the Mesopotamian Valley. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there, and I brought you out. When I brought your fathers out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Reed Sea. But they cried to the Lord for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them and covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. Then you lived in the desert for a long time. That's a nice phrase for the 40 years of wandering. But that's not important now. I brought you to the land of the Amorites, who lived east of the Jordan. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. That's the Gad, the lands of Gad, Asher, Reuben, and Manasseh, half-tribe of Manasseh. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. I destroyed them from before you, and you took possession of their land. When Balak, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you. But I would not listen to Balaam, so he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of the land. He wanted to curse them, but he couldn't do anything but bless them. And that's when the plot was to have the Moabite women entice the men, and that's Peor. Then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho. The citizens of Jericho fought against you, as did also the Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites. But I gave them into your hands. I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you, also the two Amorite kings. You did not do it with your own sword and bow, so I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities you did not build. And you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. And the whole point of that is that everything that they had did not come from the strength of their own hands. They won the victories because of the Lord. They had cities and vineyards and fields that they did not conquer or plant.
It says, I sent the hornet. What's the hornet?
Well, I think that's a picture. I would say that it was the fear of the Lord. Remember how it's repeated that when Jericho fell, then the fear of the Lord spread throughout the land. I would think that that was the hornet that went ahead of them. All right. Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt. See that idolatry hung on. Remember when Rebecca left Rachel. When Rachel left her father's home, she had the household gods with her. So there's always been this compromise. And then they might have picked some things up in Egypt, but many Egyptian people went with them, or peoples that were enslaved by the Egyptians. They brought their gods. So throw them away. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Then the people answered, far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. It was the Lord our God himself who brought us and our fathers up out of Egypt from that land of slavery, and perform those great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And see this whole description. The New Testament equivalent of this would be us recounting everything that Jesus did. From his miraculous birth, through his entire ministry, to Holy Week and his victory and on Easter and his ascension into heaven. That's the story of salvation. Well, this is the story of salvation for the children of Israel. It's everything that God did. So he protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord because he is our God. We'll, just like you, Joshua. Joshua said to the people, "You are not able to serve the Lord. He is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your rebellion and your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, he will turn and bring disaster on you and make an end of you after he has been good to you." So this rebellion, this love for idolatry was among the children of Israel. Moses had warned against it. Now Joshua is doing the same thing. But the people said to Joshua, "No, we will serve the Lord." Then Joshua said, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen to serve the Lord." "Yes, we are witnesses," they replied. "Now then," said Joshua, "throw away the foreign gods that are among you and yield your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel." And the people said to Joshua, "We will serve the Lord our God and obey him." Notice what they didn't say?
"We'll throw away the gods."
Yeah.
They had foreign gods with them.
Get rid of the gods that you worship beyond the river. That's beyond the Euphrates, you know. Or the ones that came up out of Egypt. They were just people they didn't want to depend completely on the Lord. Just like us. If we're just dependent completely on the Lord, who will take care of us? And the people said to Joshua, "We will serve the Lord our God and obey him." On that day, Joshua made a covenant for the people, and there at Shechem, he drew up for them decrees and laws, and Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God. Then he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak near the holy place of the Lord. See, he said, yeah.
It says here, Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God.
Mm-hmm.
That apparently is we do not have. Is that correct?
Oh no!
Refer to the Torah as from Moses.
Yeah.
But here it says Joshua recorded the things in the book of the law of God.
Why would you think it was another book?
Well,
there's only one book of the law of God.
Yes, and that was written by Moses.
Joshua is adding, but look what Joshua is adding. Look at what was in the chapter. It was the very same things that Moses had said. But now what is written in the book is that the people committed themselves to keeping it.
This is the section as well of the law. This section.
No.
So some people think that maybe there.
Oh, I see what the problem is.
Joseph, Joshua wrote this.
But I think that we should not assume that the book of the law of God is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. These are the. What would be the right word? The commandments that were, you know, when you read Exodus 20 and the chapters, the next three chapters, those things were written down. They're not the same as Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So when the Lord says, "Here's what I will do for you. These are the provisions, and here's the Ten Commandments, and here's what I'm requiring of you." Now Joshua is writing. He's not writing different things. Everything that's in this chapter about what the children of Israel were supposed to do is exactly the same as...
Read that again.
Yeah.
In Deuteronomy 28, verse 61, "The Lord will also bring on you every kind of sickness and disaster not recorded in this book of the law until you are destroyed." And then references, 31:24, "After Moses finished writing in a book the words of the law from beginning to end, he gave this command to the Levites who carried the ark, take this book of the law mm-hmm. and place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God. There it will remain as a witness against you.
Right.
So it would be...
And Joshua is adding these, now the children of Israel have made their own commitment to the promises, and that witness is added to the book of the law.
Yeah. Do we have them?
No.
He drew up for them decrees and laws.
Right.
I think on a timeline.
Well, what do you see the decrees and laws to be?
What? I don't know, because I have never seen Joshua's decrees.
Well, yes, but we know what the covenant is, and
yeah.
and the decrees and commandments are what God's requirements of the people are. We don't have that book. It is not Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Yeah. We do not have the book of the law of the Lord.
Okay.
Maybe it finally disappeared with the... Ark of the Covenant. I don't know that it's mentioned anywhere else. But remember who finds it.
Well,
in the temple.
In the temple.
Yeah.
But I had always assumed that that was the Torah.
You know, I think I did too. But I'm, as I think back, I think I assumed that too. But I'm not so sure that that's what it was. I think that the children of Israel did have Genesis, Exodus, that was never lost.
Okay.
But you know what? I thought the same thing. And when you're saying it, my mind is going, hey, you got to look at this and see. I find it difficult to imagine that the children of Israel could have lost the Torah. How would they have stayed who they were?
Yeah.
But the book, if you pick up this book and it says, we commit ourselves to these promises, these are what that would have inspired the young king of Judah, Hezekiah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't Hezekiah. It was...
I think you're right.
It was written... It was when
who
they...
is it? Boy, we can't remember these things.
Well...
Huh?
It was written or read by Ezra when it came back, but...
No. I'm talking about in the midst of the...
Yeah, I know, but it was also...
It isn't Hezekiah, though. I think you're right. We'd have to look.
It's just
Josiah? It could be Josiah.
Yeah.
He was one. Young King Josiah. Okay. But I think that what he found was this book of all the commandments. See, some of which are in Exodus, but not all.
But if I read the grammar of this, it says, and then Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law. I read that to be an addition to what Moses said.
But what things?
Well,
see, if you read...
Might be parts of this Joshua
It's this chapter.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
But I think what would be a critical part of it, Andy, would be that the people committed themselves. And Joshua is saying, now look, this is going to be the witness. This is going... What you say is going to be a witness against you. And so everything that they were committed to was written down, but now it's their generation.
With George.
On what?
He says this is the section he recorded.
You mean this part of the book of Joshua?
Yeah,
part. It because it says it says it's a sequel to the Pentateuch. Moses died. Was the mission and. The author the title of the book implies that Joshua is a principal character. The book itself is anonymous, although there is strong internal evidence that it was written by an eyewitness of many events which it describes.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're actually, it says the book may be the work of one of the elders who survived Joshua.
Well, but those are all thoughts about the book. What's written down in the book of the law is not the book of Joshua.
No, well, but it, this could have been kept in the tabernacle at Shechem where they were, and this could, he says, and Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law.
But you're forgetting that what we're talking about is a covenant. When you make a covenant, the king says what he will do. That's the whole part of everything that God did in the first part of the chapter. It's a recounting of that. Then, when that's done, what's written in the covenant is what it is the obligation of the people to do and the witness thereof. So I think that what is written here in the book of the law is not the story of Joshua. It is the commitment of the people, God's commitment to them, covenant, and their commitment to God. Okay, well, let's go with so this stone is set up, and the people say, or no, Joshua says to the people, "See, this stone will be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God." So it's what God says to them, and then what they say to God. Then Joshua sent the people away, each to his own inheritance. After these things, Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Serah in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything the Lord had done for Israel. And Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem in the tract of land that Jacob bought for 100 pieces of silver from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. This became the inheritance of Joseph's descendants. So, Joshua is of that tribe. So this is bringing to a conclusion the story of Joseph. And Eleazar, son of Aaron, died and was buried at Gibeah. So the generation is dying off, which had been allotted to his son Phinehas in the hill country of Ephraim. And that's the end of Joshua. Now begins the story of Judges. Judges is a remarkable book. You can see in the book of Joshua the seeds of the problems that were coming. You could already see them in the Torah because Moses said, this is what you're going to do. But Judges is the story of God's faithfulness to the children of Israel in the face of their rebellion. And it sets the stage for everything that is going to happen. Jesus will be the fulfillment of God's faithfulness and the sad story of the nation of Israel is the result of the things that they did and said in this period of time after the death of Joshua and up until the time when they asked for a king and Samuel granted their request, the period of the judges. Now, the word judge does not, I mean, what we think of as a judge has no relationship to what this book is about. Judges are leaders. But there is no king. These leaders do not take over the nation. They lead for a period of time. God is leading the children of Israel through the priests with in or decreasing success. That's what we should say. So when we're talking about Othniel, one of the first judges, we're talking about a pretty solid character. By the time we get to Samson, it's pathetic. And Samson, in his death, he finally straightens up and flies a little right, but not very much. So it's a time of decline. And while for a brief
time, in the days of David and Solomon, there was a reformation, even during the lifetime of Solomon, it declined. And after that, there was nothing good in Israel, and only brief flashes of the old faithfulness to the Lord in Judah, until finally the cup of God's anger is full, and first Israel falls to the Assyrians, and then Judah to the Babylonians. So let's take a look. Let's begin Judges. Open your minds. Use your imagination. These would be stories that would excite the children of Israel later on, those who were faithful. The nation does not do very well, but there was always a faithful remnant. Sometimes it's hard to see where the kingdom of God is. Even Elijah. Remember, Elijah couldn't see it. He said, I'm the only one left. And God says, no, there's 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. So this is an extraordinary book. It tells the story of such a great salvation that God gives, but the story of Israel's side is sad. So what happens? We're moving to the next generation. After the death of Joshua, isn't it kind of interesting how books begin that way? Exodus begins with the death of Joseph. And we keep on going like that throughout the scripture. The death of someone marks the Joshua.
You know. Both
what?
Joseph and Joshua lived 110.
Oh, 110 years. Yes. Okay.
Anything significant about that?
I don't know. I think it's, you're forced to guess, aren't you? I mean,
I think that they were old.
Yeah, right.
Probably right. Going to be longer than yourself, what you're saying.
A coincidence, but if you say anything about it, maybe it has some significance, but if it does, we don't have a clue. There's nothing in the scripture to guide us.
Moses was 120.
Yeah.
Yeah.
40 years when he went into the desert, and then 40
80,
years.
80. Yeah, 80 when he, and 120.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? The Lord answered, so they're asking the Lord, this is good. The Lord answered, Judah is to go, I have given the land into their hands. So where should we start our campaign? So under Joshua, see, this is taking longer. We have this idea in our mind that zippity-doo, it all happened in 18 months. But now Joshua is dead. He's been old for a long time. He hasn't been able to lead them. Perhaps who knows what's all involved. But they come to the Lord and they say, and the Lord says, Judah. Then the men of Judah said to the Simeonites, their brothers, come up with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. We in turn will go with you into yours. So the Simeonites went with them. When Judah attacked, the Lord gave the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hands, and they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. So it's going well. It was there that they found Adoni Bezek and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adoni Bezek fled, but they chased him and caught him, and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Well, his war days are over, aren't they? Without your thumbs and without your big toe, you're going to be out of luck. Then Adoni Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. Now God has paid me back for what I did to them. Now, this brings us to a very important point.
They brought him to Jerusalem and he died there. Joshua and Judges are books that modern day people can't handle because of the brutality of those times. But they do not look at these books from the Bible's point of view. They look at them from their own point of view. God judged the Canaanites, and the children of Israel were his weapon against them. Were the children of Israel perfect? Were they like Christ as God's warrior? No, but they were God's judging hand. And so this is the way it is. The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also and took it. So Jerusalem is not, now it's going to become, hundreds of years later, not that many hundreds, but in David's day it's going to become the capital. And they put the city to the sword and set it on fire. After that, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites. Pardon?
When we went back into Joshua 15, it said Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. And to this day, the Jebusites live there with the people of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't until the time of David before they take Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I never did understand this particular statement.
Well, I think that they beat them, but they didn't drive them out.
Well, okay.
I mean, that's all you can conclude. They won the victory, and this is the story of the initial conquering of the land. The northern tribes are going to fail. But they won the victory. The only thing is they didn't follow through, or they enslaved them, and then they regrouped and took over. So after that, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country. What cities in the hill country?
Nazareth.
Yeah. Well, no, Nazareth. That's Galilee. Yeah. This is the hill country of Judea.
This is Hebron.
And Bethlehem. Bethlehem is south. That's all the hill country of Judea, and including Hebron. So notice you've got the hill country, the Negev, that's the desert to the south, the southern area, and the western foothills. That's the...
Gaza?
No, there's a name for it. I want to say Arbala, but that's not... There's a name for that area, the foothills going down toward the Mediterranean. Is there a note there for verse 9?
South country.
Well, no, that's a negative.
There's the Sharon, but that's for the north.
Oh, well, I just can't think of it. There's a name.
Numbers 13:17?
No, just no name there.
Oh,
nothing there.
The Arbola.
Oh, you're looking. I'm sorry.
It is the
foothill
country.
Is that it? Does it say that?
Arbola.
Okay, maybe. Now, that's not sounding right to me, but there's a name for it, and that's probably it. Okay. All right, so you have the three areas. That's what's important. The hill country, the Negev, and the western foothills. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriath Arba, and defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. That's the conquering of the hill country. From there, they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer, and Caleb said, I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer. So we got, now Caleb is there. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. One day, when she came to Othniel she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What can I do for you?" So this little story is told. And throughout this first chapter, there are these little stories. She replied, she comes to her father, "Do me a special favor. Since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water." So she's smart. If you're going to have land in the Negev, you better assure yourself that you've got some water that you can control. Then Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms, that's Jericho, of course, with the men of Judah to live among the people of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath. And they totally destroyed the city. Therefore it was called Hormah, D means destruction. The men of Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. So that's the Arbela, that's the foothills heading toward the Mediterranean, the Great Sea. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots, which is an excuse. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove from it the three sons of Anak. So there's not always a judgment. It simply says what happened. The writer doesn't say, they shouldn't have worried about the iron chariots because the Lord would have been with them. He just says what happened. The Benjaminites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjaminites. So now, how did they win the victory and what happened? It can't be a contradiction, because if it was a complete contradiction, then the people who were reading it right at the beginning would have said, "What is that?" So clearly, to the people who it was first written, they understood what was being said. Now remember that cities are city-states. They're not just the city where you live, or the fortress. So it could be, one explanation might be, that the men of Judah destroyed their city but never conquered the whole land and didn't drive these people out, which is what they were supposed to do. They never did. The Jebusites stayed there. And to this day they live there with the Benjamites. Now the house of Joseph attacked Bethel. So now we're moving to the north. So we go from Judah to the house of Joseph. This is Ephraim and Manasseh, the half-tribe of Manasseh. And the Lord was with them. When they sent men to spy out Bethel, formerly called Luz, the spies saw a man coming out of the city. And they said to him, "Show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well." So apparently what happened is, they've surrounded the city, the gates have been closed, but they spot this guy coming out. And they didn't see him going over the top of the wall, so, you know, there's a way in. So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. So it's kind of like the story of Rahab, isn't it? This guy doesn't want to be killed by the Israelites, so the Lord is fighting for them. So he tells them, here's how you can sneak in. Then he went to the land of the Hittites, where he built a city and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. So the land of the Hittites would be to the north. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Beit Shan, or Taanach, or Dor, or Ebliam, or Megiddo, and their surrounding settlements. For the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. And those are Beit Shan. You remember Beit Shan, Ed? Yeah. That's where the Roman Colosseum like was there, and we went up on top of the hill. That's that valley near the Jordan. That's a rich valley. And then this is where the valleys come together, just north of the Sea of Galilee. And then you have the Jezreel Valley, and that's where Megiddo is, down going toward the Mediterranean.
Isn't that where Saul was killed?
Yes.
They have a monument there for...
Yeah, Saul and his sons were killed in a battle at Beit Shan. Yeah. Because why did they give up? There's no description of why they didn't keep on going. Maybe they got tired of fighting. Maybe they enslaved some of these people. Although that doesn't seem to be the case with Beit Shan and Megiddo. Verse 28, when Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely, like they were supposed to. So when they saw themselves as weak, they didn't conquer. When they were strong, they enslaved them, but they needed to get rid of them. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun, the tribe of Zebulun, drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahalal, who remained among them, but they did subject them to forced labor. So this is a compromise. They said, well, yeah, we didn't want to kill them all, but they made good slaves. It's always an excuse. That's the trouble with the children of Israel. They're just like us. We look at ourselves and we say, we're like the children of Israel, but maybe it would be better for us to realize that the children of Israel are just like us. No, there's nothing new under the sun, not from human point of view. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Akko or Sidon, that's along the sea, or Alab or Achzib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob. And because of this, the people of Asher lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. Neither did Naphtali drive out those those living in Beit Shemesh or Beit Anath. Beit means house. Like Bethlehem is Beit Lechem, house of bread or house of grain. And in Hebrew it's pronounced Beit, we say Beth. But the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. And God said, don't do that. And those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country, not allowing them to come down to the plain. And the Amorites were determined also to hold out in Mount Heres, Ajalon, and Sha'albim. And when the power of the house of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor. So it was a process when they got strong enough, instead of driving them away or killing them, they pressed them into forced labor. The boundary of the Amorites was from Scorpion Pass to Sela and beyond.
You know, it's surprising to me, having seen the land of Israel, how small it is, that you could have that many cities in that confined area. It must have been awfully close together.
Oh, yeah.
And they were small cities, I know.
And they were fighting all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't have cars to drive back and forth.
Yeah. No. It took a little while, yeah.
Well, right.
Yeah, we made it from Tiberias to Jerusalem in a day, and we stopped at Jericho for 3 hours or whatever we were there.
Yeah, great trip.
Yeah, it's 80 miles, you know. So, all right. Now, chapter 2 is going to be the pattern for the book of Judges. So it's very important. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim. Bochim means weeper, and said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. Now, I think it becomes pretty clear here that the angel of the Lord is the Lord. And so once again, we may have the pre-incarnate Christ. You never really can settle that. But what is clear is that the messenger of the Lord is the Lord, because the I just keeps repeating, and it's clearly God, not an angel. It is the angel of the Lord. So I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now therefore I tell you that I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. Ooh. You know, it would be like God saying to us, I told you to stay away from materialism, but now materialism is going to become the snare for you. When the angel of the Lord had spoken these things to all the Israelites, the people wept aloud, and they called that place Weepers. There they offered sacrifices to the Lord. Well, so what's the question? All the Lord got was a little water? That's a question for which there isn't an answer, but you're talking about a nation. So there were always those who were faithful to the Lord, the remnant. But Israel as a nation was not. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. So that's a connection between the end of Joshua and the beginning of Judges. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres. So in Joshua, it's known as Timnath-Seres. Here it's Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Does it mean that they didn't know what God had done? I don't think so. They knew what God had done, but they didn't know the Lord. And they didn't understand all the wonderful things that he had done for them. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals.
That phrase keeps coming up over and over.
Yes, they served the Baals and did evil in the eyes of...
Did evil.
Yeah. But let's take a little break here. One of the things that is clear in Genesis 1 is that sex is an activity of human beings. We do not think of God as a sexual being, and he is not. But that is not the way the ancient peoples thought. So the people who serve the Baals, hang on to that just a little bit. Let's go a little wider first and then come back to the Canaanites. Look at the Romans and the Egyptians is true, the Egyptians too. But we know the Romans gods and the Greek gods better. Greek and Roman gods are sort of the same, you know. Rome just took over the Grecian culture. They're just human beings writ large. You know, they have affairs, and they're just human beings. But God is not. And God did not want the children of Israel to get involved in this false religion that suggested that somehow or another, human sexuality was not simply a gift from God, but was what the gods did. So imagine what happened to the children of Israel. They've heard all about their God. The chronicler tells us that they didn't know the Lord and what he did. But that's the word that Job uses when he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. They didn't trust the Lord. They didn't know him. They didn't understand his love and everything that he had done. So it does not mean that they did not know about God. So here they are in the land. They refuse to drive out these people. And what would these people say to the children of Israel? Would they say, you know, your God, the God of Israel, the Lord, the God of Israel, is a false God. He doesn't exist. They would hardly say that, would they? Because it was with the power of the Lord that Jericho had fallen and that God had given them the victory. These people knew what had happened in Egypt. When 40 years before that, God brought Egypt to its knees and brought the children of Israel out. But we're told repeatedly in the scripture that their reputation went in front of them and struck fear into the hearts of people. So what did they say? Well, I don't know for sure, but you can imagine a Canaanite talking to a Jewish guy and saying, you know, why don't you come to our Wednesday evening service? You know, your God does big things, but you've got to worry about everyday things. You know, are you going to have children? How are your flocks going to do? What about your grain? You know, nothing works without sex. But see, who's Baal? Baal is the male god of the thunderstorm. And unless he reigns on the land, the female god Ashtoreth, nothing grows. And these Canaanites believed that apparently Baal and Ashtoreth needed a little stimulation. So you go to the temple where the temple prostitutes are serving, and you have sex with them, and that gets the gods going. And we get a little rain, and everything works. And this is, the children of Israel simply can't resist this. It sucks them in. And that's why God had told them, get rid of these people. This corruption is going to influence everything. And so throughout this whole period of time, they don't, in general, stop worshiping God and start worshiping Baal. They're just playing both sides against the middle. So we've got, as long as we've got the temple in Jerusalem, remember in the days of Jeremiah, they just can't believe that God is, Jeremiah has to tell them that the temple is going to be destroyed. Jerusalem, and they think it's terrible, all these things that are going to happen. Ezekiel as well. They just can't believe it, because God, he takes care of those. He takes care of our land. But, you know, we got to get along with the other things. And so we do exactly the same thing. You know, if we're going to die, then we need God. He takes care of the really big battles. But in everyday life, you've got to worry about the almighty buck. You got to take care of yourself. It's just so easy to find the parallels. Human beings in our sinful nature have never changed. There is nothing new under the land. So, verse 11, then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers. And because of the nature of the Canaanite religion, that's why idolatry and adultery are seen as one and the same thing.
He connects forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of Egypt, in so many different references, doesn't he? He refers to Egypt again and their their fathers.
Yeah, the God, just like we would say.
The three things.
God, well, yeah, okay, but those are phrases, what do they mean to us? We always talk about how God delivers us, destroys the shroud of death, and conquers death forever. You know, and that's obviously, I mean, God takes care of all the things. But then when we get to our everyday life, you got to take care of yourself.
Well, yeah, well, we are people, I mean, it's crazy because we look back and we say, well, that was crazy, but they were, I mean, God is the God of life, and we're going to die, but we don't think about that. And we think that, well, before we die, we've got to do something else. And that's...
Well, that may be. It depends on how many funerals you go to.
That's the problem. We know very well that we're going to die, but that's no big deal. We got to take care of today.
Yeah, you know why? Because we're still caught up in the religion of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, a religion that says that life is an ever-turning wheel. And so since everybody who came into the world is going to die, why worry about it? But the God who called Abraham out of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley called him to a religion that isn't an ever-turning circle, but is linear. It starts with the creation of the world, and it's going to end with, and wherever you are, you're going to be a part of what God is doing.
We're going to die.
Yeah.
I have a question in my own mind. At this period of time, how they practiced their religion. There were no synagogues at that time. There were just the city of the Levite cities.
Well, that's where the Levites lived, yeah.
Yeah, but they apparently had to observe the Sabbath. But I have never heard whether there was any instructions.
Sure. In Deuteronomy, write them upon your hands on the forehead. You have to instruct your children. And when they get up in the morning, when they lie down at night, when you come and when you go, they were to be instructing their children all the time. But it was a family-based thing. Because the whole nation of Israel was based on family.
Well, when we get to the time of the temples, we have a very fixed ritual type of program going on. But I do not see in this period of time that they came to sacrifice.
Well, sure. You just read about it. The Gad and not Ephraim, Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben.
Well, they set up an altar.
But they said, we're not going to make any sacrifices on it. We're going to make those sacrifices at the temple.
Except there was no temple, just
the tabernacle. Well, the tabernacle. But they still had an altar of burnt offering. And everything, I mean, the temple was simply a permanent tabernacle.
Yeah, but when we get to the time of the temple, we have fixed requirements for the priest of the things that they were to do and so on and so forth.
Those were set up by Moses.
And they talked about, earlier about the fact that about sacrifice.
It's our time. Yeah, right.
Disagreement there.
Well, in David's day, there was all this organization of the choirs and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it got more elaborate or more laid out. But all of the rules about the sacrifices and what was to be done were in Leviticus and Exodus. And sometimes they didn't keep them. That's true. You know. But they were all laid out. It's that time. So we're right in the midst of this paradigm, if you will, a paradigm.
Yeah.
that's going to set up the rest of the book of Judges. So we'll pick this up next time.